when I last went to visit Grace at home, what I was most struck by was the love, that she was in a cocoon of love, that you, Shay, and her caretakers, Rick, overall, just enveloped her in, that also included her books, discussions, her passion right to the end, Alice.
Yes. We tried to do what was right by Grace. She had always loved us. She had always given us books. She had always been there to talk when one needed to talk. And I think that we were able to. Grace beat two full terms of hospice care and got kicked out eventually. So we thought that we did our job. And then she gently let go yesterday morning.
Well,
so,
Alice,
yes, our dear friend.
Our condolences and congratulations for being a part of this great woman's life and being there with her to the end. Alice Jennings, close friend and caretaker of Grace Lee Boggs, lawyer and board member of the James and Grace Lee Boggs Center. Grace Lee Boggs died yesterday at the age of 100. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 5 o'clock. Stay tuned for the Tuesday KBOO Evening News. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Port Orford Sustainable Seafood, Oregon's community-supported fishery, delivering monthly shares of line-caught seafood direct from the small fishing town of Port Orford to seafood-loving communities throughout Portland and the Willamette Valley. Details at posustainableseafood.com and at 541-671-0704.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Vibe of Portland's fall fundraising event, October 2nd from 5 to 9 at Tabor Space in Portland. Vibe exists because arts education is missing in today's daily educational system. Vibe connects local teaching artists who are passionate about bringing their love of music and visual arts to the students they work with. At this event, you can learn about where Vibe has been this last year and see where they're headed. There will be food, a silent auction, and entertainment by the Barra Brown Trio. Again, that's the Vibe of Portland's fall fundraising event, October 2nd from 5 to 9 at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of How We Got On at the Portland Playhouse, Wednesday through Sundays until October 25th. Directed by Jen Rowe, How We Got On is the story of three teenagers in the suburbs of the Midwest who dream of fame in the golden age of hip-hop in the late 80s. That's How We Got On, Wednesdays through Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. through October 25th at the Portland Playhouse, 602 Northeast Prescott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hip-hopping is the thing that's in. It's where the Stone Cold Nitro party begins. So listen, party people with the ear to the street, the college professor and the social elite, to the fly young guys and the pretty girl. IT is going to tell you about the hip-hop world. Hip-hopping is a way of life.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, two civil suits have been filed against Monsanto alleging that Roundup herbicide causes cancer.
6,000 people will get early release from federal prison due to changes in sentencing laws.
And an initiative petition has been filed to reform the initiative process. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 6th, 2015. I'm Jared Dantzler.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. A measure to reform Oregon's initiative law has been filed with the Secretary of State. The group Restore the Initiative is currently gathering their first 1,000 qualified signatures in order to get a ballot title. The measure would prevent the state legislature from repealing or amending any law enacted through the initiative process without getting permission from the voters. KABU reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Larry Becker and Mark Miller, chief petitioners for the measure, to learn more.
The entire time we've had the initiative process here in Oregon, the legislature has had the power to amend or even repeal a law passed by the voters. That's been true since 1902, and it was explicitly ruled this way in 1905 by the Oregon Supreme Court. But despite that fact, the Oregon legislature and governor have never before actually passed laws that made significant changes to any voter passed ballot measure without first sending those changes back to the voters for a referendum. This is something they're allowed to do under the Constitution, but not required to do. And it makes sense, if you think about it, that they would send these things back to the voters, because what good is a voter initiative if they can simply ignore it? Well, with HB 3400 signed into law by the governor in July, it marks the first time in Oregon history, together with another law in 2014, that the legislature has simply ignored the will of the voters and the governor signed it into law. And we propose a constitutional amendment that would simply require the legislature to submit any changes that they want to make to a law passed by the voters back to the voters, as they've always done in the past.
So you're looking at basically a complete ban on legislative tampering?
I suppose you could call it a complete ban on legislative tampering, except for the fact that this is what they've always done traditionally. So it would technically be a ban on legislative tampering. They would require a vote by the people to approve it, but that's what they've always done in the past. Even with the most controversial ballot measures ever passed in the state of Oregon, like, you know, I hate to say it, death with dignity, and even measure 37, which required, reimbursing city and county government, or city and county governments rather, to reimburse property owners for property value lost due to zoning regulation. That thing was a financial catastrophe, and yet the legislature respected the will of the voters, and eventually a compromise was reached and approved by the voters. Put another way, legislation passed by the people can never constitute an emergency, and so they should. So there's nothing strange about getting them to ask our approval.
There's also the way this was handled. It leaves a taste in the mouth, at least to many voters we've talked to, that the legislature, in essence, was saying, run along, children, let the adults make the laws. In other words, it's as if they weren't perceiving that the voters really understand what's going on here. It's almost a paternal attitude. And in a way, this is making sure that what the people say is respected and listened to. And if the legislature disagrees and they want to make a change, they can send it back for the voters' approval. And we are supposed to be the last word here. And the fact is that if they can do it to these measures this way, there's the potential for possibly changing any measure that was passed by the people in the past or the future. In a way, to me, this restores the equivalency, the equalness of the people and the legislature and the governor, which was meant to be in place when they first passed the legislation.
Again, I'm speaking with Larry Becker and Mark Miller with the Committee to Restore the Initiative, an Oregon political action committee that's circulating a ballot measure to prevent legislative tampering, essentially, with laws that are created through the initiative process. This is Doug McVeigh with KABU News.
The U.S. Bureau of Prisons reported today that federal prisons held about 8,500 fewer people this year than the year before. They also announced that due to changes in sentencing law, at the end of October, about 6,000 people who had been serving time for drug offenses were to be released early. KABU reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Mary Price, general counsel with the organization Families Against Mandatory Minimums, to learn more.
This has actually been in the works for quite some time due to a rule change promulgated by the U.S. Sentencing Commission. Could you tell our listeners exactly what this entails?
Absolutely. The Sentencing Commission writes what are called sentencing guidelines, and those guidelines help judges decide what sentence to impose for a variety of offenses, including drug offenses. A little over a year ago, the Sentencing Commission reduced all drug sentences by what are called two levels that rounds out to an average of 24 months per prisoner, although some prisoners would get even shorter sentences or larger reductions. So going forward, people are facing shorter sentences, but the question remained, what about people who are serving prison sentences under the old rules? And so the commission decided to do what it could under the law and made that decision retroactive. And that means that people sentenced under the old regime could petition the court for a comparable reduction to their sentence. The one thing that the commission did was to set that sort of the implementation off for a year until November 1st of this year so that the courts, the government, the Bureau of Prisons, and prisoners themselves could use the year to get ready for early release. So the people who are being released starting on November 1st, some of them had their sentences reduced and would already be out a month ago, but they've been waiting because they set off the implementation to help everybody get ready for this day. So that 6,000 number seems like a really big number, but in fact, it's sort of accumulated orders over a year's period of time.
I should mention, by coincidence, the Bureau of Prisons announced yesterday that at the end of fiscal year 2015, there were about 8,400 fewer people in federal prison than the year before. Mm-hmm. They also say that we're now down to just 23% over capacity in the federal systems. Could you comment on those figures, please?
Sure. I mean, just 23% over capacity does sound like an advance, and it is. They've been up much higher overcapacity numbers, but I think a number of steps have been taken by all sort of players to try and get a handle on the overpopulation in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Drugs minus two retroactivity and drugs minus two going forward is one piece of that. People are going to be sentenced to shorter terms. They're going to get out earlier than they would ordinarily or under the old regime. The Department of Justice has changed its charging practices for prosecutors. They're telling prosecutors not to charge mandatory minimums in every case or enhanced sentences. I mean, there's a variety of steps that are being taken to try and get a grip on the problem of over-incarceration.
One report I saw indicated that another 8,500 people may become eligible for release over the following year. Mm-hmm. Now, that same report said that more than 40,000 could become eligible for early release. At this rate, that would take several years. Is that actually likely to be the case?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it'll take a number of years for everybody who has been sentenced under old sentencing guidelines to get the benefit of the new sentencing guidelines. But you will not see another 6,000 prisoner release day. As I said, these people have been sort of piling up, waiting for the first to come so that they could be released. But now, in the second year of implementation, people will get their sentencing reduction orders from the court. The court will send them to the Bureau of Prisons. The Bureau of Prisons will then release the person on the date that they're sentence ends. And that will take place in a much more, I don't want to say orderly, because I'm sure November 1st will be orderly as well, but you know what I mean. It will take place on a sort of a less number-heavy day process, rather.
Basically, the Bureau of Prisons won't try to make quite as big a splash.
Well, and it's not the Bureau of Prisons' fault. It's the natural consequence of saying you can't start releasing people until a certain day. The commission decided to do that, as I said earlier, in order to make sure everybody was prepared for this. But what that meant, what the consequence of that was that a lot of people were sort of waiting to get released, and now they're going to get released.
Now, Mary, any closing thoughts, and where can people find out more about Families Against Mandatory Minimums?
Oh, thank you. Well, FAM has a website, and it is www.fasinfrank.org. And a final word, I think that I'm very encouraged by this news. I mean, we can sort of look at these 6,000 as a great, you know, sort of a lot of people being released on a single day as being a rather alarming event. But I think we can also look at it as being a very important event. And these are people, every single one of whom has been looked at carefully by a judge, by a prosecutor, by a probation officer to ensure that they, number one, are entitled to release, and number two, that their release would not harm public safety. And what we are doing is recognizing that we are simply releasing them to the prison term they would get were they sentenced today. And it strikes me that it would be profoundly unfair to keep a person in prison longer than we think is necessary or important. So I'm actually very encouraged about this, and I'm looking forward to these releases as well as other measures that our lawmakers and policymakers can take to begin to reduce our reliance on over-incarceration.
Mary, thank you so much. Again, I've been speaking with Mary Price. She's general counsel at the organization Families Against Mandatory Minimums. They're on the web at famm.org. Mary, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
Graduate students who work as teaching and research assistants are organizing at private universities throughout the U.S. They're forming unions, demanding recognition for those unions, and asking for better pay and benefits. But private universities aren't legally required to recognize grad student unions, and most have refused to do so. In New York City, FSRN reporter Elis O'Neill caught up with a couple of those involved in the ongoing fight for recognition.
The grad student union at Columbia University has been busily holding meetings and organizing incoming grad students since the start of the school year. So far, the union's an informal one, unrecognized by the school's administration. Olga Brudostova is a third-year PhD student in the engineering department.
Our major goal today is to have a contract and to sit down together with the administration representatives and to negotiate it.
Private universities are under no obligation to recognize grad student unions. In 2004, the National Labor Relations Board ruled that graduate students at private universities are primarily students, not workers. That's despite the fact that many grad students at public universities are unionized under state laws. Paul Katz, a third-year PhD student at Columbia, says in his opinion, grad students are workers at all major research universities.
We do work for the university. We are effectively employees here, at least insofar as our teaching is concerned. When I am sitting at the front of a classroom of 17 undergrads talking, for instance, this semester about ancient Greece, which isn't even related to my research, there's no doubt that my relationship to the university is one of a worker. And I believe that in the United States, workers have the right to organize under the National Labor Relations Act.
A spokesperson for the university responded to FSRN's interview request with a written statement. It reads, quote, Columbia's graduate students are scholars in training whose teaching and research are an integral part of their doctoral studies. Treating students as employees could adversely affect their educational experience. The statement concluded that a one-size-fits-all contract would harm students' academics and individualized mentorship. But Paul Katz counters that improved salaries and benefits would in fact give grad students more time and energy to devote to their teaching and research.
A lot of people are concerned about health care. Many people are concerned about the lack of dental insurance. Many people have expressed concern that, for instance, if you live in Columbia-owned housing, your rent is guaranteed to increase at least 4% every year. Stipends, not so much. We've also seen lots of concerns about the lack of due process that we have, about uneven fees. So I think, you know, there's really a wide range of concerns, but what unites them all is a belief that we have the right to collectively bargain over the conditions under which we work.
Graduate student organizing died down at private universities across the country in the decade after the 2004 NLRB ruling. but in November 2013, New York University chose to voluntarily recognize its grad student union. And in March of this year, the grad students there negotiated a new contract. Sixth-year PhD student David Claussen explains the gains from those negotiations.
Making sure that healthcare was across the board, pushing for family healthcare, which before had been $9,000 to cover a spouse, and, you know, $5,000 for dependent, which is just unreasonable, especially when stipends are $25,000 range. We made some gains, not as much as is necessary.
The NYU students' relative success sparked a wave of optimism in organizing. Grad students at Columbia, the New School, Yale, Harvard, and the University of Chicago have started to form unions. Paul Katt says he and others organized a card drive at Columbia, in which grad students signed cards saying they wanted to be represented by a union.
It was really probably one of the most energizing, exciting moments of my entire life, this sort of 3.5 months of you know, conversations continually, card signings all the time, knocking on lab doors and graduate lounges, you know, bothering as many people as possible just to figure out what they cared about and whether we could, you know, bring them on board.
1,700 of Columbia's 2,800 grad students signed cards. That's a healthy majority, so the grad students took the cards to the administration, asking for recognition. No response was forthcoming. So organizers took their cards to the National Labor Relations Board, hoping to overturn the 2004 decision that grad students at private universities are not employees.
We're now waiting for a decision on whether or not these folks will have a right to have a union election.
Maida Rosenstein's with the United Auto Workers, affiliated with Columbia's grad students.
You know, we feel very optimistic that we're going to get a good decision.
On October 15th, graduate students at 7 universities are holding events to raise awareness about their unionization campaigns. The goal's bigger than just improving working conditions for grad students, says David Claussen, a student organizer at NYU.
Universities have sort of shifted from hiring tenure-track people to hiring grad students because it's cheaper. We're hoping that we're making it more difficult by actually saying, no, you can't just use us to like get rid of tenure-track people because we're not going to be paid as little as you can possibly pay us. We're going to push our wages higher.
In the meantime, Columbia University's administration has hired a major law firm to represent them on this case. There's no date set for when the National Labor Relations Board will rule, but students are hopeful they'll make a decision soon. Ailish O'Neill, FSRN, New York City.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Melinda St. Louis of Global Trade Watch says the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal reached in secret by corporate negotiators is bad for America and must be stopped in Congress.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership, it's branded as a trade agreement, but it is not about trade. It really is a wish list of the largest multinational corporations and what they weren't able to get through our democratic process. And that's why you see expanded monopolies for brand name drugs. You see rollback of regulation for Wall Street. You see a rollback of Buy American or Buy Local policies to reinvest our tax dollars at the local level. You see incentives to offshore jobs in the United States. And it was negotiated in secret behind closed doors with 600 corporate advisors who had access to the text who were able to influence what the deal is while the public has been locked out.
St. Louis says there is significant opposition to TPP in Congress.
They can't amend it, so therefore they need to vote it down. It's going to be attacked by both the left and the right, and so I think its prospects in Congress are highly uncertain. Already there are 10 presidential candidates who have come out criticizing TPP, including Republican frontrunner Donald Trump has been very, very vociferous against TPP. Bernie Sanders came out today saying he would work doing anything he could to defeat TPP. Hillary Clinton has distanced herself from TPP because of the strong Democratic opposition.
For more information on TPP, you can go to expositheTPP.org or tradewatch.org.
The White House Worker Voice Summit on Wednesday will feature many activists and leaders in the movement to improve the lives of working people, among them Alicia Almada, an RN from California, who was fired for speaking up for union representation on the job. National Nurses United says Almada was a leader in the nurses' union campaign at Huntington Memorial in Pasadena, California. According to the union, management at that medical facility used various union-busting tactics, including illegal ones. Despite an NLRB complaint citing seven instances of breaking labor law, management kept up its union-busting campaign right through an election in April of this year. NNU is disputing results of that union election since intimidation tactics were used against the nurses supporting a union. NNU has also filed charges seeking Almada's reinstatement, along with another union supporter who was also fired.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And now for a two-minute lesson in labor history, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society.
And this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1996. 15,000 workers at the General Motors plant in Quebec walked off the job. Members of the Canadian Auto Workers Union were frustrated with their wages. They were also angry about layoffs and General Motors' move to outsource some of the auto production to non-unionized labor. One striker explained, GM doesn't want to have 30-year people anymore. They want temporary workers who they can pay lower wages. The Canadian Auto Workers had won an agreement with Chrysler that guaranteed the company would not sell off any Canadian parts plants. But GM refused to make a similar promise. During the strike, the union reported that General Motors' $39 billion profit last year was the largest single corporate profit ever recorded in Canadian history. The union argued that much of this profit came from underpaying Canadian workers. Canadians only accounted for 8% of the company's North American workforce, but they generated 42% of GM's total profit on the continent. Soon, GM workers at other Canadian plants joined the strike, which swelled to 26,000 workers. As the strike wore on, its impact was felt beyond the Canadian borders. Thousands of GM workers in the United States were temporarily laid off. The parts they built were not needed because of the strike in Canada. It is estimated that 90,000 cars were not produced because of the strike. Finally, after nearly 3 weeks, the union and the company reached an agreement. The workers won a 2% annual raise in addition to their cost of living increase, but they also agreed that GM could sell off two of its plants and allow GM the right to do more outsourcing of parts from outside suppliers. And for that, the workers at those plants were guaranteed their wage level for 3 years. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a KBOO News in Depth. Jim Thompson speaks with Kathy Kelly about the bombing of a hospital in Afghanistan. Was it a war crime? This will be followed by LGBTQ Arts, hosted by Ashley Brittner, at 7. It's Hard Knock Radio. News and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with a low around 59. Tomorrow, a 30% chance of rain with a high near 70. Today in history, in 1536, William Tyndale, the English translator of the New Testament, is strangled and burned at the stake for heresy. In 1973, Israel is attacked by Egypt, Syria, Iraq, and Jordan, beginning the Yom Kippur War. In 1981, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat was shot to death by extremists while reviewing a military parade. The quote of the day is from Martin Luther King Jr. History will have to record that the greatest tragedy of this period of social transition was not the strident clamor of the bad people, but the appalling silence of the good people.
It's 5:28. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Just when you think that self-delusional right-wing extremists can't get any more delusional, they're now going after Ahmed Mohammed. He's the 14-year-old All-American boy from Irving, Texas, who recently built a homemade clock, proudly taking it to his school to show it off. But rather than being congratulated for ingenuity and craftsmanship, Ahmed was greeted by some so-called adult teachers at MacArthur High School as an Islamic terrorist. In a ridiculous knee-jerk reaction to an American-born inventive boy who just happens to be Muslim, they called in the bomb squad. If someone named Alfred Mulholland had brought the clock to class, he would have been hailed for creativity. Irving police stormed in, arrested Ahmed on criminal charges, handcuffed him, and hauled him and his bomb off to jail. Of course, he was soon released since the bomb was, you know, a clock. But oh gollies, then came the goofballs. Glenn Beck, goofball-in-chief, weighed in to proclaim apocalyptically, "For some reason, Irving is important to Islamists." Generalissimo Beck then asserted that terrorists planted Ahmed there and planned his arrest as a, quote, dog whistle to call in a jihadist invasion. Friends, I've been to Irving. While its mayor is prone to giving anti-Muslim speeches, it is not, I repeat, not a place ISIS would consider a prize worthy of capture. But don't count on reality or any level of common sense to penetrate the dunderheads of Beckensian goofballism. They'll even trample a 14-year-old boy, again, an all-American, smart, enterprising youngster, to serve their grim, fearful political agenda. This is Jim Hightower saying, the Ahmed Mohammeds are our hope for a brighter America. And already, this bright fellow has inadvertently invented a device that exposes Islamophobes. There ought to be a Nobel Prize for that.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Apparently, the herbicide Roundup is not as harmless as Monsanto would have you believe. Two lawsuits have been filed recently against the agribusiness giant, claiming that handling Roundup has caused leukemia in 64-year-old Judy Fitzgerald and bone cancer in 58-year-old Enrique Rubio. Rubio claims in his suit that his condition stemmed from exposure to Monsanto's widely popular weed killer and other pesticides that he sprayed on cucumber, onion, and other vegetable crops. Fitzgerald's suit states that Monsanto led a prolonged campaign of misinformation to convince government agencies, farmers, and general population that Roundup was safe. The main ingredient in Roundup, glyphosate, was listed as a possible human carcinogen 6 months ago by the World Health Organization. The lawsuit claim that after pressure from Monsanto, the Environmental Protection Agency changed an initial classification for glyphosate from possibly carcinogenic to humans to evidence of non-carcinogenicity in humans. Monsanto has furiously denied these claims and says its products are safe, but the agricultural and biotech company is battling a string of negative health and safety accusations. Early last month, California's Environmental Protection Agency issued plans to list glyphosate as known to cause cancer.
The American Academy of Pediatrics, AAP, has announced it plans to end its corporate partnership with Monsanto following the efforts of Momovation, a group of mom bloggers. Founder and food activist Leah Segedy in July pointed out to AAP the impact of its connection with Monsanto, saying that partnering with a company that makes DDT, PCBs, Agent Orange, glyphosate, and GMOs for a living isn't consistent with the AAP's mission. Segedy said, "I was completely shocked that the American Academy of Pediatrics, an organization that moms put their trust in at some of the most vulnerable times in children's lives, was associating with a company that didn't elicit trust at all." The AAP got back to Segedy in late September, and she was able to announce at the eco-blogging conference, organized by ShiftCon, that the AAP would sever ties with Monsanto at the end of the year. "It has been a tough year for Monsanto, what with severed partnerships, legal challenges, and organized resistance to their products in the EU, as well as in the US. Monsanto has been deemed the third most hated company in the United States this year by the Harris Poll measuring reputation quotient, which basically means how people feel about them.
The head of the government in Alberta, Canada, has come out against tar sands as a long-term energy source. Alberta holds the continent's largest reserve of tar sands oil and is the origin of the oil that would travel through proposed Enbridge and Keystone XL pipelines. The Alberta leader is due to unveil the new policy ahead of the International UN Climate Conference in Paris this December. It puts her at odds with Stephen Harper, the Canadian Prime Minister, who is a major proponent of the fossil fuel industry. The announcement by the Alberta Premier comes just as a coalition of environmental groups are in court today, making the case for why the federal government's approval of Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline should be revoked. The province of Alberta sits atop the world's third biggest known carbon reserves in the tar sands and has rapidly increased production to around 2 million barrels of crude a day. By 2020, the province will account for more than a third of Canada's total carbon pollution, according to government figures. Environmental groups have targeted tar sands, together with coal, as particularly dirty forms of energy because of its energy-intensive extraction and its widespread destruction of boreal forests.
And now, something a little different from H2O Radio, This Week in Water.
Anti-fracking movement had an unlikely start. Tony Ingraffia, now a professor emeritus of engineering at Cornell, spent the first 25 years of his career consulting to the oil and gas industry.
We're sitting with him in Denver, Colorado at the National Stop the Frack Attack Conference, where he's just finished a standing room only presentation.
So, Tony, we're curious, how did a career in oil and gas lead you here, speaking to anti-fracking activists?
It all started 30 miles up the road from where we're sitting.
He got his PhD from the University of Colorado at Boulder, studying rock fracture mechanics. His research would help companies like Schlumberger and ExxonMobil figure out how to best get oil and gas out of rock. Getting it out of shale, however, was a problem that seemed impossible.
It wasn't until about 10 years ago that somebody had figured out how to do it. And Ingraffia told EcoWatch that he was aghast at the eventual solution, pumping high volumes of water, sand, and chemicals through long stretches of vertical and lateral pipes deep into a formation.
But more disturbing was what happens on the surface, what he calls spatial intensity. Drilling into shale requires a large number of big wells clustered together.
And those wells are leaky. They emit methane, which is dozens of times more potent than CO2 as a greenhouse gas. And the problem isn't confined to drilling activities. Methane is released during compression and other processes such as surface transportation.
So even though this is an anti-fracking conference, he's quick to point out that hydraulic fracturing isn't the heart of the problem. Instead, it's getting off shale oil and gas completely, something he calls managing the decline.
10 or 20 years ago, we would have been in a much better position to manage that decline. But shale came along. It's given the industry an extra boost in life for 10 years. So at the very time, 10, 15, 20 years ago, that we should have been very serious on an international level about managing the decline in the use of fossil fuels, along came shale, more methane leakage, exacerbation of climate change, all the impacts on water, direct and indirect.
So let's talk about the impacts to water. Clearly, there are direct threats to water and groundwater from drilling and fracking, but there are indirect ways in which water is affected by fossil fuel extraction.
We've been dumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution.
So managing the decline means that you can't precipitously, instantaneously, in one day, one month, one year, get that substantial decrease in the use of fossil fuels.
That starts with keeping fossil fuels in the ground that haven't been extracted and slowing production of existing wells. He also thinks that methods like a carbon tax would decrease supply by reducing demand.
But the biggest and most important solution, that comes from us.
The people of the world say, I don't want to drive a gasoline-powered car. I don't want to heat my home with natural gas. I don't want to use electricity generated from a coal-fired power plant.
But these lifestyle choices rely on powerful interests making them available to us.
I'm not talking about revolution. I'm talking about working within the constraints of the capitalist system.
Yes, but a capitalist system that still allows and even encourages companies like Shell to drill in the Arctic. And even though Shell recently halted its exploration there, Ingraffia says they'll be back. Rex Tillerson, CEO of ExxonMobil, said earlier this year that they have to. The shale revolution is going to end, so the Arctic is the next logical step.
So the USGS estimates that the formation that Shell was drilling in could hold as much as 7 billion barrels of oil. My reaction to that is, who the hell cares? 7 billion barrels of oil is 1 year's supply for the entire United States. If you want to spend hundreds of millions of dollars for each well, and what you're going to do is prolong the life of your business model for a few years and delay in the deployment of renewable energy, I don't think a board with a heart and a soul and a sense of morality is going to stand for that for very long. If we continue the demand, or even increase, unfortunately, the demand for fossil fuels, then the science is clear. We will reach somewhere between 1.5 and 2 degrees centigrade global warming, and all the tipping points that we've talked about, many of which have to do with water. Too much of it, too little of it, or stuff we can't drink.
A total of 19 European countries have opted out of growing genetically modified crops within all or part of their territories. A European Commission rule passed in March allows its 28 members bloc to abstain from growing GMO crops even if they are already authorized to be grown. Along with 13 others, France, Denmark, and Austria have opted out completely, while Germany, Belgium, and the UK are applying the rule for only part of their territories. All 28 EU nations require GMO labeling. The member nations specifically banned the cultivation of Monsanto's MON810 corn, the only GMO crop presently grown in Europe. GMO crops like Monsanto's MON810 and DuPont's Pioneers 1507, another proposed genetically engineered corn strain, produce a pesticide called BT, which is toxic to insects. Monsanto's website states that politicians using scientific arguments, rejected by the EU's own food safety authority, have taken decisions to illegally ban the planting of MON810 corn hybrids, despite a robust safety assessment and a long history of safe cultivation and consumption. A spokesperson for Greenpeace Food Policy said last week that these countries don't trust EU safety assessments and are rightly taking action to protect their agriculture and food. There are currently 7 other GMO crops, corn crops specifically, under review and awaiting approval by the Commission.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, October 6, 2015. Israeli troops attack Palestinian protesters all over the West Bank, injuring more than 100 civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in occupied West Bank has reported that at least 129 Palestinians have been injured by Israeli army fire and gas bombs in different parts of the West Bank Tuesday, and that the soldiers deliberately targeted medics and journalists. According to the ministry report, 50 wounded Palestinians were transferred to the Palestine Medical Center in Ramallah. Two of them suffered serious injuries after being shot with live Israeli rounds, while the rest suffered mild to moderate wounds. It added that 11 Palestinians were shot with rubber-coated metal bullets in Bethlehem. 7 more Palestinians were shot with rubber-coated steel bullets, while many residents suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation in the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Furthermore, 45 Palestinians were injured in Nablus and 16 in Jenin, both in the northern part of the West Bank, suffered mild to moderate injuries. Media sources in Jenin said that 2 were shot with live rounds and dozens suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation during clashes near the Al-Jalama roadblock north of Jenin. The soldiers also invaded a pottery store near the roadblock and kidnapped the owner after assaulting him. Head of the emergency unit of the Red Crescent in Jenin, Mohammed Saadi, said that the soldiers attacked medics and deliberately opened fire on a Red Crescent ambulance near Ramallah, smashing its windshield. Elsewhere, Israeli forces on Tuesday demolished two homes belonging to the families of Palestinians who carried out attacks on Israelis last year, just hours after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called for a new process to expedite home demolitions. Locals in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Jabal al-Mukabbir told reporters that early on Tuesday morning, Israeli forces stormed the home of Muhammad Ja'abis and Ghassan Abu Jamal and demolished them with explosives. Ghassan Abu Jamal was shot dead along with his cousin Uday after they killed four Israelis in a high-profile attack on a synagogue in November of last year. Separately, Ja'abis was shot dead when he ran an excavator into an Israeli bus, killing one and injuring several others. Locals said that the neighborhood homes sustained damage during Tuesday's demolition. Meanwhile, in a third house, also in East Jerusalem, Israeli forces filled a room with concrete. Israeli forces stormed and ransacked the home of Mu'taz Hijazi family in Silwan neighborhood before filling Hijazi's former room with concrete. Hijazi was shot dead on the roof of the house on October 30, 2014, after he was accused of attempting assassination of right-wing rabbi activist Yehuda Glick. Israeli forces detained all family members and moved them away from the home, local sources reported.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Cliff Verla, Doug McVeigh, and Jim Thompson. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. And the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Jared Dantzler.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul Rowland welcomes Reverend Billy of the Church of Stop Shopping. Listen to the glorious bird song of the Stop Shopping Choir. Join the Citizen Weed Pulling Brigade. Exorcise the devil Monsanto from Portland's public park.